Have you got the money for a cup of tea, mate? Yes, thank you, said Dirk. I'm fine. His attention was fully occupied with the eagle, and he didn't immediately look round. No, I mean, can you spare me a bob or two, just for a cup of tea? What? This time Dirk looked around, irritably. Oh, just a fag, mate. Got a fag you can spare? No, I was just going to go and get some myself, said Dirk. The man on the pavement behind him was a tramp of indeterminate age. He was standing there, slightly wobbly, with a look of wild and continuous disappointment bobbing in his eyes. Not getting an immediate response from Dirk, the man dropped his eyes to the ground about a yard in front of him, and swayed back and forth a little. He was holding his arms out, slightly open, slightly away from his body, and just swaying. Then he frowned suddenly at the ground, then he frowned at another part of the ground. Then, holding himself steady, while he made quite a major realignment of his head, he frowned away down the street. "Have you lost something?" said Dirk. The man's head swayed back towards him. "Have I lost something?" he said in querulous astonishment. "Have I lost something?" It seemed to be the most astounding question he had ever heard. He looked away again for a while, and seemed to be trying to balance the question in the general scale of things. This involved a fair bit more swaying and a fair few more frowns. At last he seemed to come up with something that might do service as some kind of answer. "The sky?" he said, challenging Dirk to find this a good enough answer. He looked up towards it, carefully, so as not to lose his balance. He seemed not to like what he saw in the dim, orange, street-lit pallor of the clouds, and slowly looked back down again till he was staring at a point just in front of his feet. "The ground?" he said, with evident great dissatisfaction, and then was struck with a sudden thought. "Frogs!" he said, wobbling his gaze up to meet Dirk's rather bewildered one. "I used to like frogs," he said, and left his gaze sitting on Dirk, as if that was all he had to say, and the rest was entirely up to Dirk now. Dirk was completely flummoxed. He longed for the times when life had been easy, life had been carefree, the great times he had had with a mere homicidal eagle, which seemed now to be such an easy-going and amiable companion. Aerial attack he could cope with, but not this nameless roaring guilt that came howling at him out of nowhere. "What do you want?" he said in a strangled voice. "Just a fag, mate," said the tramp. "Or something for a cup of tea?" Dirk pressed a pound coin into the man's hand and lunged off down the street in a panic, passing 20 yards further on a builder's skip, from which the shape of his old fridge loomed at him menacingly. As Kate came down the steps from her house, she noticed that the temperature had dropped considerably. The clouds sat heavily on the land and lowered at it. Thor set off briskly in the direction of the park, and Kate trotted along in his wake. As he strode along, an extraordinary figure on the streets of Primrose Hill, Kate could not help but notice that he had been right. They passed 3 different people on the way, and she saw distinctly how their eyes avoided looking at him, even as they had to make allowance for his great bulk as he passed them. He was not invisible, far from it. He simply didn't fit. The park was closed for the night, but Thor leapt quickly over the spiked railings, and then lifted her over in turn, as lightly as if she had been a bunch of flowers. The grass was damp and mushy, but still worked its magic on city feet. Kate did what she always did when entering the park, which was to bob down and put the flats of her hands down on the ground for a moment. She had never quite worked out why she did this, and often she would adjust a shoe or pick up a piece of litter as a pretext for the movement. But all she really wanted was to feel the grass and the wet earth on her palms. The park, from this viewpoint, was simply a dark shoulder that rose up before them, obscuring itself. They mounted the hill, and stood on the top of it, looking over the darkness of the rest of the park, to where it shaded off into the hazy light of the heart of London, which lay to the south. Ugly towers and blocks stuck yobbishly up out of the skyline, dominating the park, the sky, and the city. A cold, damp wind moved across the park, flicking at it from time to time like the tail of a dark and broody horse. There was an unsettled, edgy quality to it. In fact, the night sky seemed to Kate to be like a train of restless, irritable horses, their traces flapping and slapping in the wind. It also seemed to her as if the traces all radiated loosely from a single centre, and that the centre was very close by her. She reprimanded herself for absurd suggestibility, but nevertheless it still seemed that all the weather was gathered and circling around them, waiting on them. Thor once more drew out his hammer, and held it before him in the thoughtful and abstracted manner she had seen a few minutes before in her flat. He frowned and seemed to be picking tiny invisible pieces of dust off it. It was a little like a chimpanzee grooming its mate, or, that was it, the comparison was extraordinary, but it explained why she had tensed herself so watchfully when last he had done it. It was like Jimmy Connors minutely adjusting the strings of his racket before preparing to serve. He looked up sharply once again, drew his arm back, turned fully once, twice, three times, twisting his heels heavily in the mud, and then hurled his hammer with astonishing force up to the heavens. It vanished almost instantly into the murky haze of the sky. Dark flashes sparked deep within the clouds, tracking its path in a long parabola through the night. At the furthest extent of the parabola, it swung down out of the clouds, a tiny, distant pinpoint, moving slowly now, gathering and redirecting its momentum for the return flight. Kate watched breathless, as the speck crept behind the dome of St. Paul's. It then seemed almost as if it had halted altogether, hanging silently and improbably in the air, before gradually beginning to increase microscopically in size as it accelerated back towards them. Then, as it returned, it swung aside in its path, no longer describing a simple parabola, but following instead a new path, which seemed to lie along the perimeter of a gigantic Möbius strip, which took it around the other side of the telecom tower. Then suddenly, it was swinging back in a path directly towards them, hurtling out of the night with impossible weight and speed, like a piston in a shaft of light. Kate swayed and nearly dropped in a dead faint out of its path, when Thor stepped forward and caught it with a grunt. The jolt of it sent a single heavy shudder down into the earth, and then the thing was resting quietly in Thor's grip. His arm quivered slightly, and was still. Kate felt quite dizzy. She didn't know exactly what it was that had just happened, but she felt pretty damn certain that it was the sort of experience that her mother would not have approved of on a first date. "Is this all part of what we have to do to go to Asgard?" she said. "Or are you just fooling around?" "We will go to Asgard now," he said. At that moment he raised his hand as if to pluck an apple. But instead of plucking, he made a tiny, sharp turning movement. The effect was as if he had twisted the entire world through a billionth part of a billionth part of a degree. Everything shifted, was for a moment minutely out of focus, and then snapped back again, as a suddenly different world. This world was a much darker one, and colder still. A bitter, putrid wind blew sharply, and made every breath gag in the throat. The ground beneath their feet was no longer the soft, muddy grass of the hill, but a foul-smelling, oozing slush. Darkness lay over all the horizon, with a few small, exceptional fires dotted here and there in the distance, and one great blaze of light, about a mile and a half away to the southeast. Here, great fantastical towers stabbed at the night. Huge pinnacles and turrets flickered in the firelight that surged from a thousand windows. It was an edifice that mocked reason, ridiculed reality, and jeered wildly at the night. "My father's palace," said Thor, "the great hall of Valhalla, where we must go." It was just on the tip of Kate's tongue to say that something about the place was oddly familiar, when the sound of horses' hooves pounding through the mud came to them on the wind. At a distance, between where they stood and the great hall of Valhalla, a small number of flickering torches could be seen jolting towards them. Thor once more studied the head of his hammer with interest, brushed it with his forefinger, and then rubbed it with his thumb. Then slowly he looked up. Again he twisted round once, then twice, and a third time, and then hurled the missile into the sky. This time, however, he continued to hold on to its shaft with his right hand, while with his left he held Kate's waist in his grasp. Cigarettes clearly intended to make themselves a major problem for Dirk tonight. For most of the day, except for when he'd woken up, and except for again shortly after he'd woken up, and except for when he had just encountered the revolving head of Geoffrey Anstey, which was understandable, and also except for when he'd been in the pub with Kate, he had had absolutely no cigarettes at all. Not one. They were out of his life, forsworn utterly. He didn't need them. He could do without them. They merely nagged at him like mad and made his life a living hell, but he decided he could handle that. Now, however, just when he had suddenly decided, coolly, rationally, as a clear, straightforward decision, rather than merely a feeble surrender to craving, that he would, after all, have a cigarette, could he find one? He could not. The pubs by this stage of the night were well closed. The late-night corner shop obviously meant something different by late night than Dirk did. And though Dirk was certain that he could convince the proprietor of the rightness of his case through sheer linguistic and syllogistic bravado, the wretched man wasn't there to undergo it. A mile away, there was a 24-hour filling station, but it turned out just to have sustained an armed robbery. The plate glass was shattered and crazed around a tiny hole. Police were swarming over the place. The attendant was apparently not badly injured, but was still losing blood from a wound in his arm, having hysterics, and being treated for shock. And no one would sell Dirk any cigarettes. They simply weren't in the mood. "You could buy cigarettes in the Blitz," protested Dirk. "People took a pride in it. Even with the bombs falling and the whole city ablaze, you could still get served. Some poor fellow, just lost two daughters and a leg, would still say plain or filter tip if you asked him." "I expect you would too," muttered a white-faced young policeman. "He was the spirit of the age," said Dirk. "Bug off," said the policeman. And that, thought Dirk to himself, was the spirit of this. He retreated, miffed, and decided to prowl the streets with his hands in his pockets for a while. Camden Passage. Antique clocks. Antique clothes. No cigarettes. Upper Street. Antique buildings being ripped apart. No sign of cigarette shops being put in their place. Chapel Market. Desolate at night. Wet litter wildly flapping. Cardboard boxes, egg boxes, paper bags and cigarette packets. Empty ones. Pentonville Road. Grim concrete monoliths, eyeing the new spaces in Upper Street where they hoped to spawn their horrid progeny. King's Cross Station. They must have cigarettes, for heaven's sake. Dirk hurried on down towards it. The old frontage to the station reared up above the area, a great yellow brick wall, with a clock tower and two huge arches fronting the two great train sheds behind. In front of this lay the one-story modern concourse, which was already far shabbier than the building, 100 years its senior, which had obscured and generally messed up. Dirk imagined that when the designs for the modern concourse had been drawn up, the architects had explained that it entered into an exciting and challenging dialogue with the older building. King's Cross is an area where terrible things happen to people, to buildings, to cars, to trains, usually while you wait. And if you weren't careful, you could easily end up involved in a piece of exciting and challenging dialogue yourself. You could have a cheap car radio fitted while you waited, and if you turned your back for a couple of minutes, it would be removed while you waited as well. Other things you could have removed while you waited were your wallet, your stomach lining, your mind, and your will to live. The muggers and pushers and pimps and hamburger salesmen, in no particular order, could arrange all these things for you. But could they arrange a packet of cigarettes, thought Dirk, with a mounting sense of tension. He crossed York Way, declined a couple of surprising offers on the grounds that they did not involve cigarettes in any immediately obvious way, hurried past the closed bookshop and in through the main concourse doors, away from the life of the street, and into the safer domain of British Rail. He looked around him. Here things seemed rather strange, and he wondered why. But he only wondered this very briefly, because he was also wondering if there was anywhere open selling cigarettes, and there wasn't. He sagged forlornly. It seemed to him that he had been playing catch-up with the world all day. The morning had started in about as disastrous a way as it was possible for a morning to start, and he had never managed to get a proper grip on it since. He felt like someone trying to ride a bolting horse, with one foot in the stirrup, and the other one still bounding along hopefully on the ground behind. And now, even the simpler thing as a cigarette was proving to be beyond his ability to get hold of. He sighed and found himself a seat, or at least room on a bench. This was not an immediately easy thing to do. The station was more crowded than he had expected to find it at... What was it? He looked up at the clock. 1 o'clock in the morning. What in the name of God was he doing on King's Cross Station at 1 o'clock in the morning, with no cigarette and no home that he could reasonably expect to get into without being hacked to death by a homicidal bird? He decided to feel sorry for himself. That would pass the time. He looked around himself, and after a while the impulse to feel sorry for himself gradually subsided as he began to take in his surroundings. What was strange about it was seeing such an immediately familiar place looking so unfamiliar. There was the ticket office, still open for ticket sales, but looking sombre and beleaguered, and wishing it was closed. There was the W. H. Smith, closed for the night. No one would be needing any further newspapers or magazines tonight, except for purposes of accommodation, and old ones would do just as well for sleeping under. The pimps and hookers, drug pushers and hamburger salesmen were all outside in the streets and in the hamburger bars. If you wanted quick sex or a dirty fix or, God help you, a hamburger, that was where you went to get it. Here were the people that nobody wanted anything from at all. This was where they gathered for shelter, until they were periodically shooed out. There was something people wanted from them, in fact, their absence. That was in hot demand, but not easily supplied. Everybody has to be somewhere. Dirk looked round from one to another of the men and women shuffling around or sitting hunched in seats or struggling to try and sleep across benches that were specifically designed to prevent them from doing exactly that. Got a fag, mate? What? No, I'm sorry. No, I haven't got one, replied Dirk, awkwardly patting his coat pockets in embarrassment, as if to suggest the making of a search which he knew would be fruitless. He was startled to be summoned out of his reverie like this. Here you are, then. The old man offered him a beat-up one from a beat-up packet. What? Oh, thanks. Thank you. Momentarily taken aback by the offer, Dirk nevertheless accepted the cigarette gratefully and took a light from the tip of the cigarette the old man was smoking himself. What you come here for, then? Asked the old man. Not challenging, just curious. Dirk tried to look at him without making it seem as if he was looking him up and down. The man was wildly bereft of teeth, had startled and matted hair, and his old clothes were well mulched down around him. But the eyes which sagged out of his face were fairly calm. He wasn't expecting anything worse than he could deal with to happen to him. Well, just this, in fact, said Dirk, twiddling the cigarette. Thanks, couldn't find one anywhere. Oh, ah, said the old man. Got this mad bird at home, said Dirk, kept attacking me. Oh, ah, said the man, nodding resignedly. I mean, an actual bird, said Dirk, an eagle. Oh, ah, with great wings. Oh, ah, got hold of me with one of its talons through the letterbox. Oh, ah. Dirk wondered if it was worth pursuing the conversation much further. He lapsed into silence and looked around. You're lucky it didn't slash at you with its beak as well, said the old man after a while. An eagle will do that when roused. It did, said Dirk. It did. Look, right here on my nose. That was through the letterbox as well. You'd scarcely believe it. Talk about grip. Talk about reach. Look what it did to my hand. He held it out for sympathy. The old man gave it an appraising look. Oh, ah, he said at last, and retreated into his own thoughts. Dirk drew his injured hand back. Know a lot about eagles, then, do you? The man didn't answer, but seemed instead to retreat still further. A lot of people here tonight, Dirk ventured again after a while. The man shrugged. He took a long drag on his cigarette, half-closing his eyes against the smoke. Is it always like this? I mean, are there always so many people here at night? The man merely looked down, slowly releasing the smoke from his mouth and nostrils. Yet again Dirk looked around. A man a few feet away, not so old-looking as Dirk's companion, but wildly deranged in his demeanour, had sat nodding hectically over a bottle of cooking brandy all his time. He slowly stopped his nodding, screwed with difficulty a cap onto the bottle, and slipped it into the pocket of his ragged old coat. An old fat woman, who had been fitfully browsing through the bulging black bin-liner of her possessions, began to twist the top of it together and fold it. You'd almost think that something was about to happen, said Dirk. Oh, ah, said his companion. He put his hands on his knees, bent forward, and raised himself painfully to his feet. Though he was bent and slow, and though his clothes were dirt-ridden and tattered, there was some little power and authority there in his bearing. The air, which he unsettled as he stood, which flowed out from the folds of his skin and clothes, was richly pungent even to Dirk's numbed nostrils. It was a smell that never stopped coming at you. Just as Dirk thought it must have peaked, so it struck on upwards with renewed frenzy, till Dirk thought that his very brain would vaporize. He tried not to choke. Indeed, he tried to smile courteously, without allowing his eyes to run, as the man turned to him and said, "Infuse some blossom of the bitter orange. Add some sprinklings of sage while it is still warm. This is very good for eagle wounds. There are those who will add apricot and almond oil, and even, the heavens defend us, cedra. But then there are always those that will overdo things, and sometimes we have need of them. Oh, ah." With that, he turned away once more, and joined the growing stream of pathetic, hunched, and abused bodies that were heading for the front exit from the station. In all, about 2, maybe 3 dozen were leaving. Each seemed to be leaving separately, each for his or her entirely independent reasons, and not following too fast the one upon the other. And yet it was not hard to tell, for anyone who cared to watch these people, that no one cared to watch or see, that they were leaving together, and in a stream. Dirk carefully nursed his cigarette for a moment or so, and watched them intently as one by one they left. Once he was certain that there were no more to go, and that the last 2 or 3 of them were at the door, he dropped the cigarette and ground it out with his heel. Then he noticed that the old man had left behind his crumpled cigarette packet. Dirk looked inside, and saw that there were still 2 bedraggled cigarettes left. He pocketed it, stood up, and quietly followed at a distance that he thought was properly respectful. Outside, on the Euston Road, the night air was grumbling and unsettled. He loitered idly by the doorway, watching which way they went, to the west. He took one of the cigarettes out and lit it, and then idled off westwards himself, around the taxi rank, and towards St. Pancras Street. On the west side of St. Pancras Street, just a few yards north of the Euston Road, a flight of steps leads up to the forecourt of the old Midland Grand Hotel, the huge, dark, Gothic fantasy of a building which stands empty and desolate across the front of St. Pancras Railway Station. Over the top of the steps, picked out in gold letters on wrought iron work, stands the name of the station. Taking his time, Dirk followed the last of the band of old tramps and derelicts up these steps, which emerged just to the side of a small squat brick building which was used as a car park. To the right, the great dark hulk of the old hotel spread off into the night, its roofline a vast assortment of wild turrets, gnarled spires and pinnacles which seemed to prod at and goad the night sky. High in the dim darkness, silent stone figures stood guard behind long shields, grouped around pilasters behind wrought iron railings. Carved dragons crouched gaping at the sky as Dirk gently, in his flapping leather coat, approached the great iron portals which led to the hotel and to the great vaulted train shed of St. Pancras Station. Stone figures of winged dogs crouched down from the tops of pillars. Here, in the bridged area between the hotel entrance and the station booking hall, was parked a large, unmarked, grey Mercedes van. A quick glance at the front of it was enough to tell Dirk that it was the same one that had nearly forced him off the road several hours earlier in the Cotswolds. Dirk walked into the booking hall, a large space with great panelled walls, along which were spaced fat marble columns, in the form of torch holders. At this time of night, the ticket office was closed. Trains do not run all night from St. Pancras. And beyond it, the vast chamber of the station itself, the great Victorian train shed, was shrouded in darkness and shadow. Dirk stood quietly secluded in the entrance to the booking hall, and watched as the old tramps and bag ladies, who had entered the station by the main entrance from the forecourt, mingled together in the dimness. There were now many more than 24 of them, perhaps as many as 100, and there seemed to be about them an air of repressed excitement and tension. As they moved about, it seemed to Dirk after a while that though he had been surprised at how many of them there had been when he first arrived, there seemed now to be fewer and fewer of them. He peered into the gloom, trying to make out what was happening. He detached himself from his seclusion in the entrance to the booking hall, and entered the main vault, but kept himself nevertheless as close to the side wall as possible, as he ventured in towards them. There were definitely fewer still of them now, a mere handful left. He had a distinct sense of people slipping away into the shadows and not re-emerging from them. He frowned at them. The shadows were deep, but they weren't that deep. He began to hurry forward, and quickly threw all caution aside to reach the small remaining group. But, by the time he reached the centre of the concourse where they had been gathered, there were none remaining at all, and he was left whirling round in confusion in the middle of the great, dark, empty railway station. The only thing which prevented Kate screaming was the sheer pressure of air rushing into her lungs as she hurtled into the sky. When, a few seconds later, the blinding acceleration eased a little, she found she was gulping and choking, her eyes were stinging and streaming to the extent that she could hardly see, and there was hardly a muscle in her body which wasn't gibbering with shock as waves of air pummeled past her, tearing at her hair and clothes, and making her knees, knuckles, and teeth batter at each other. She had to struggle with herself to suppress her urge to struggle. On the one hand, she absolutely did not want to be let go of. Insofar as she had any understanding at all of what was happening to her, she knew that she did not want to be let go of. On the other hand, the physical shock of it was facing some stiff competition from her sheer affronted rage at being suddenly hauled into the sky without warning. The result of this was that she struggled rather feebly and was angry at herself for doing so. She ended up clinging to Thor's arm in the most abject and undignified way. The night was dark, and the blessing of this, she supposed, was that she could not see the ground. The lights she had seen dotted here and there in the distance now swung sickeningly away beneath her, but her instincts would not identify them as representing ground. Already the flickering beacons which shone from the insanely turreted building she had glimpsed seconds before this outrage occurred were swaying away behind her now at an increasing distance. They were still ascending. She could not struggle, she could not speak. She could probably, if she tried, bite the stupid brute's arm, but she contented herself with the idea of this rather than the actual deed. The air was bad and rasped in her lungs. Her nose and eyes were streaming, and this made it impossible for her to look forward. When she did try it, just once, She caught a momentary blurred glimpse of the head of the hammer streaking out through the dark air ahead of them, of Thor's arm grasping its stunted handle and being pulled forward by it. His other arm was gripped around her waist. The strength of him defied her imagination, but did not make her any the less angry. She got the feeling that they were now skimming along just beneath the clouds. Every now and then, they would be buffeted by damp clamminess, and breathing would become yet harder and more noxious. The wet air tasted bitter and deadly cold, and her streaming wet hair lashed and slammed around her face. She decided that the cold was definitely going to kill her, and after a while she was convinced that she was beginning to lose consciousness. In fact, she realized, she was actually trying to lose consciousness, but she couldn't. Time slipped into a greyness, though, and she was less aware of how much of it was passing. At last she began to sense that they were slowing, and that they were beginning to curve back downwards. This precipitated fresh waves of nausea and disorientation in her, and she felt that her stomach was being slowly turned through a mangle. The air was, if anything, getting worse. It smelled worse, tasted more acrid, and seemed to be getting a great deal more turbulent. They were definitely slowing now, and the going was becoming more and more difficult. The hammer was clearly pointing downwards now, and finding its way along, rather than surging ahead. Down still further they went, battling through the thickening clouds that swirled around them, till it seemed that they must now reach all the way down to the ground. Their speed had dropped to the point where Kate felt able to look ahead now, though the acridity of the air was such that she was only able to manage a very brief glance. In the moment that she glanced, Thor released the hammer. She couldn't believe it. He released it only for a fraction of a second, just to change his grip on the thing, so that they were now hanging from the shaft as it flew slowly forward, rather than being pulled along by it. As he redistributed his weight into this new posture, he hoisted Kate firmly upwards, as if pulling up a sock. Down they went, and down, further and further. There was now a roaring, crashing sound borne in on them by the wind from up ahead, and suddenly Thor was running, leaping over rocky, sandy scrubland, dancing through the knotted tussocks, and finally pounding and drumming his feet to a halt. They stood still at last, swaying, but the ground on which they stood was solid. Kate breathed for a few seconds, bending over to catch her breath. She then pulled herself up to a full height, and was about to deliver a full account of her feelings concerning these events at the top of her voice, when she suddenly got an alarming sense of where she was standing. Though the night was dark, the wind whipping at her, and the pungent smell of it, told her that some kind of sea was very close by. The sound of wild, crashing breakers told her that in fact it was more or less beneath her, that they were standing very near to the edge of a cliff. She gripped the arm of the insufferable god who had brought her here, and hoped, vainly, that it hurt him. As her reeling senses began gradually to calm down, she noticed that there was a dim light spreading away before her, and after a while she realized that this was coming off the sea. The whole sea was glowing like an infection. It was rearing itself up in the night, lunging and thrashing in a turmoil of itself, and then smashing itself to pieces in a frenzy of pain against the rocks of the coast. Sea and sky seethed at each other in a poisonous fury. Kate watched it speechlessly, and then became aware of Thor standing at her shoulder. "I met you at an airport," he said, his voice breaking up in the wind. "I was trying to get home to Norway by plane," he pointed out to sea. "I wanted you to see why I couldn't come this way."
"Where are we? What is this?"
asked Kate fearfully. "In your world, this is the North Sea," said Thor, and turned away inland again, walking heavily and dragging his hammer behind him. Kate pulled her wet coat close around her and hurried after him.
"Well, why didn't you just fly home the way we just did, but in our world?"
The rage in her had subsided into vague worries about vocabulary. "I tried," responded Thor, still walking away.
"Well, what happened?"
"I don't want to talk about it."
"What on earth's the point of that?"
"I'm not going to discuss it." Kate shuddered in exasperation.
"Is this godlike behavior?" she shouted. "It bothers you so you won't talk about it?" "Thor! Thor! Is it you?"
This last was a thin voice trailing over the wind. Kate peered into the wind. Through the darkness, a lantern was bobbing towards them from behind a low rise.
"Is that you, Thor?"
A little old lady came into view, holding a lantern above her head, hobbling enthusiastically.
"I thought that must be your hammer I saw. Welcome," she chirped. "Oh, but you come in dismal times. I was just putting the pot on and thinking of having a cup of something, and then perhaps killing myself. But then I said to myself, 'Just wait a couple of days longer, Tsuliwa, Tsuwila, Tsuliwa insis.' I can never pronounce my own name properly when I'm talking to myself, and it drives me hopping mad. As I'm sure you can imagine, such a bright boy as I've always maintained, never mind what those others say, so I said to myself, Zuluiensis, see if anyone else comes along, and if they don't, well, then might be a good time to think about killing myself. And look, now here you are. Oh, but you are welcome, welcome. And I see you've brought a little friend. Are you going to introduce me? Hello, my dear, hello. My name's Zuluiensis, and I won't be at all offended if you stutter. I'm a Kate, said Kate, totally flummoxed. Yes, well, I'm sure that will be all right, said the old woman sharply. Anyway, come along if you're coming. If you're going to hang around here all night, I may as well just get straight on with killing myself now, and let you get your own tea when you're quite ready. Come along. She hurried on ahead, and in a very few yards they reached a terrible kind of ramshackle structure of wood and mud, which looked as if it had become unaccountably stuck while halfway through collapsing. Kate glanced at Thor, hoping to read some kind of reaction from him, to give her a bearing on the situation. But he was occupied with his own thoughts, and was clearly not about to share them. There seemed to her to be a difference in the way he moved, though. In the brief experience she had of him, he seemed constantly to be struggling with some internal and constrained anger, and this, she felt, had lifted. Not gone away, just lifted. He stood aside to allow her to enter Zuluiensis's shack, and briskly gestured her to go in. He followed, ducking absurdly, a few seconds later, having paused for a moment outside to survey what little could be seen of the surrounding landscape. Inside was tiny. A few boards with straw for a bed, a simmering pot hung over a fire, and a box tucked away in the corner for sitting on.
"And this is the knife I was thinking of using, you see," said Zuluiensis, fussing around. "Just been sharpening it up nicely. You see, it comes up very nice if you get a nice sweeping action with the stone. And I was thinking, here would be a good place. You see, here on the wall, I can stick the handle in this crack so it's held nice and firm, and then just go, fling, and fling myself at it. Fling, you see? I wonder, should it be a little lower? What do you think, my dear? Know about these things, do you?"
Kate explained that she did not, and managed to sound reasonably calm about it. "Zuluiensis," said Thor. "We have come not to stay, but to... Zulu, please put the knife down." Zuluiensis was standing looking at them quite chirpily, but she was also holding the knife, with its great heavy sweeping blade, poised over her own left wrist.
"Don't mind me, dears," she said. "I'm quite comfortable. I can just pop off any time I'm ready. Happy to. These times are not to live in. Oh, no, you go off and be happy. I won't disturb your happiness with the sound of me screaming. I'll hardly make a sound with the knife as you go."
She stood, quivering and challenging. Carefully, almost gently, Thor reached out and drew the knife away and out of her shaking hand. The old woman seemed to crumple as it went, and all the performance faded out of her. She sat back in a heap on the box. Thor squatted down in front of her, slowly drew her to him and hugged her. She gradually seemed to come back to life, and eventually pushed him away, telling him not to be so stupid, and then made a bit of a fuss, smoothing out her hopelessly ragged and dirty black dress. When once she had composed herself properly, she turned her attention to Kate, and looked her up and down.
"You're a mortal, dear, aren't you?"
she said at last.
"Well, yes," said Kate. "I can tell it from your fancy dress. Oh, yes. Well, now you see what the world looks like from the other side, don't you, dear? What do you think, then?"
Kate explained that she did not yet know what to think. Thor sat himself down on the floor, and leant his big head back against the wall, half-closing his eyes. Kate had the sense that he was preparing himself for something.
"It used to be things were not so different," continued the old woman. "Used to be lovely here, you know, all lovely. Bit of give and take between us. Terrible rows, of course. Terrible fights. But really, it was all lovely. Now..."
She let out a long and tired sigh, and brushed a bit of nothing much off the wall.
"Oh, things are bad," she said. "Things are very bad. You see, things get affected by things. Our world affects your world. Your world affects our world. Sometimes it is very hard to know exactly what that effect is. Very often it is hard to like it, either. Most of them these days are difficult and bad. But our worlds are so nearly the same in so many ways. Where in your world you will have a building, there will be a structure here as well. Maybe it will be a small muddy hillock, or a beehive, or an abode like this one. Maybe it'll be something a little grander, but it'll be something. You all right, Thor, dear?"
The Thunder God closed his eyes and nodded. His elbows lay easily across his knees. The ragged strips of Kate's nightgown, bound about his left forearm, were limp and wet. He idly pushed them off.
"And where there is something that is not properly dealt with in your world," the old lady prattled on, "as like as not it'll emerge in ours. Nothing disappears, no guilty secret, no unspoken thought. It may be a new and mighty god in our world, or it may just be a gnat, but it will be here. I might add that these days it is more often a gnat than a new and mighty god. Oh, there are so many more gnats and fewer immortal gods than once there were.
How can there be fewer immortals? Asked Kate.
I don't want to be pedantic about it, but...
Well, there's being immortal, dear, and then again there's being immortal. I mean, if I could just get this knife properly secured and then work up a really good fling, we'd soon see who was immortal and who wasn't.
Sully, admonished Thor, but didn't open his eyes to do it.
One by one we're going, though. We are, Thor. You're one of the few that care. There's few enough now that haven't succumbed to alcoholism or the onks.
What is that, some kind of disease? Asked Kate. She was beginning to feel cross again, having been dragged unwillingly from her flat and hurled across the whole of East Anglia on the end of a hammer. She was irritated at being then just abandoned to a conversation with an insanely suicidal old woman, while Thor just sat and looked content with himself, leaving her to make an effort she was not in a mood to make.
It's an affliction, dear, which only gods get. It really means that you can't take being a god any more, which is why only gods get it, you see.
I see.
In the final stages of it, you simply lie on the ground, and after a while a tree grows out of your head, and then it's all over. You rejoin the earth, seep into its bowels, flow through its vital arteries, and eventually emerge as a great pure torrent of water, and as like as not get a lot of chemical waste dumped into you. It's a grim business being a god nowadays, even a dead god.
Well, she said, patting her knees. Her eyes hovered on Thor, who had opened his eyes, but was only using them to stare at his own knuckles and fingertips.
Well, I hear you have an appointment tonight, Thor.
Hmm, grunted Thor, without moving.
I hear you've gathered together the great hall for the challenging hour, is that right?
Hmm, said Thor.
The challenging hour, hmm? Well, I know that things have not been too good between you and your father for a long time, hmm?
Thor wasn't going to be drawn. He said nothing.
I thought it was quite dreadful about Wales, continued Sulliwiensis. Don't know why you stood for it. Of course, I realize that he's your father, and the All-Father, which makes it difficult, but Odin, I've known him for so long. You know that he made a deal once to sacrifice one of his own eyes in exchange for wisdom. Of course you do, dear, you're his son, aren't you? Well, what I've always said is he should stand up and make a fuss about that particular deal, demand his eye back. Do you know what I mean by that, Thor? And that terrible toe-rag. There's someone to be careful of, Thor, very careful indeed. Well, I expect I shall hear all about it in the morning, won't I?
Thor slid his back up the wall and stood up. He clasped the old woman warmly by the hands and smiled a tight smile, but said nothing. With a slight nod, he gestured to Kate that they were leaving. Since leaving was what she most wanted in all the world to do, she resisted the temptation to say, oh yeah, and kick up a fuss about being treated like this. Meekly, she bowed a polite farewell to the old woman and made her way out into the murky night. Thor followed her. She folded her arms and said, well, where now? What other great social events have you got in store for me this evening? Thor prowled around a little, examining the ground. He pulled out his hammer and weighed it appreciatively in his hands. He peered out into the night and swung the hammer a couple of times, idly. He swung himself round a couple of times, again, not hard. He loosed the hammer, which bounded off into the night, and split open a casually situated rock a couple of dozen yards away, and then bounded back. He caught it easily, tossed it up into the air, and caught it easily again. Then he turned to her, and looked her in the eye for the first time. "Would you like to see something?" he asked. A gust of wind blew through the huge vaults of the empty station, and nearly provoked in Dirk a great howl of frustration at the trail that had so suddenly gone cold on him. The cold moonlight draped itself through the long ranges of glass panels that extended the length of the St. Pancras station roof. It fell on empty rails and illuminated them. It fell on the train departures board. It fell on the sign which explained that today was a blue saver day, and illuminated them both. Framed in the archway formed by the far end of the vaulted roof were the fantastical forms of five great gasometers, the supporting superstructures of which seemed in their adumbrations to be tangled impossibly with each other, like the hoops of an illusionist's conjuring trick. The moonlight illuminated these as well, but Dirk it did not illuminate. He had watched upwards of 100 people or so simply vanish into thin air, in a way that was completely impossible. That in itself did not give him a problem. The impossible did not bother him unduly. If it could not possibly be done, then obviously it had been done impossibly. The question was how. He paced the area of the station which they had all vanished from, and scanned everything that could be seen from every vantage point within it, looking for any clue, any anomaly, anything that might let him pass into whatever it was he had just seen 100 people pass into, as if it was nothing. He had the sense of a major party taking place in the near vicinity, to which he had not been invited. In desperation, he started to spin around with his arms outstretched, then decided this was completely futile and lit a cigarette instead. He noticed that as he had pulled out the packet, A piece of paper had fluttered from his pocket, which, once the cigarette was burning well, he stooped to retrieve. It was nothing exciting, just the bill he had picked up from the stroppy nurse in the cafe. Outrageous, he thought about each of the items in turn, as he scanned down them, and was about to screw it up and throw it away, when a thought struck him about the general layout of the document. The items charged were listed down the left-hand side, and the actual charges down the right. On his own bills, when he issued them, when he had a client, which was rare at the moment, and the ones he did have seemed unable to stay alive long enough to receive his bills and be outraged by them, he usually went to a little trouble about the items charged. He constructed essays, little paragraphs, to describe them. He liked the client to feel that he or she was getting his or her money's worth, in this respect, at least. In short, the bills he issued corresponded in layout almost exactly to the wad of papers with indecipherable runic scripts, which he had been unable to make head or tail of a couple of hours previously. Was that helpful? He didn't know. If the wad was not a contract, but a bill, what might it be the bill for? What services had been performed? They must certainly have been intricate services, or at least intricately described services. Which professions might that apply to? It was at least something to think about. He screwed up the cafe bill and moved off to throw it into a bin. As it happened, this was a fortuitous move. It meant that he was away from the central open space of the station, and near a wall against which he could press himself inconspicuously, when he suddenly heard the sound of two pairs of feet crossing the forecourt outside. In a few seconds, they entered the main part of the station, by which time Dirk was well out of sight behind the angle of the wall. Being well out of sight worked less well for him in another respect, which was that for a while he was unable to see the owners of the feet. By the time he caught a glimpse of them, they had reached exactly the same area where a few minutes previously a small horde of people had quietly, and without fuss, vanished. He was surprised by the red spectacles of the woman, and the quietly tailored Italian suit of the man, and also the speed with which they themselves then immediately vanished. Dirk stood speechless. The same two damn people who had been the bane of his life for the entire day, he allowed himself this slight exaggeration on the grounds of extreme provocation, had now flagrantly and deliberately disappeared in front of his eyes. Once he was quite certain that they had absolutely definitely vanished, and were not merely hiding behind each other, he ventured out once more into the mysterious space. It was bafflingly ordinary. Ordinary tarmacadam, ordinary air, ordinary everything. And yet, a quantity of people that would have kept the Bermuda Triangle industry happy for an entire decade had just vanished in it within the space of 5 minutes. He was deeply aggravated. He was so deeply aggravated that he thought he would share the sense of aggravation by phoning somebody up and aggravating them, as it would be almost certain to do at 1:20 in the morning. This wasn't an entirely arbitrary thought. He was still anxious concerning the safety of the American girl, Kate Schechter, and he had not been at all reassured to have been answered by her machine when last he had called. By now she should surely be at home and in bed asleep, and would be reassuringly livid to be woken by a meddling phone call at this time. He found a couple of coins and a working telephone, and dialed her number. He got her answering machine again. It said that she had just popped out for the night to Asgard. She wasn't certain which parts of Asgard they were going to, but they would probably be swinging by Valhalla later, if the evening was up to it. If he cared to leave a message, she would deal with it in the morning, if she was still alive and in the mood. There were some beeps, which rang on in Dirk's ear for seconds after he heard them. "Oh," he said, realizing that the machine was currently busy taping him. "Good heavens, well, I thought the arrangement was that you were going to call me before doing anything impossible." He put the phone down, his head spinning angrily. "Valhalla, eh? Was that where everybody was going tonight except him? He had a good mind to go home, go to bed, and wake up in the grocery business. Valhalla." He looked about him once again, with the name Valhalla ringing in his ears. There was no doubt, he felt, that a space this size would make a good feasting hall for gods and dead heroes, and that the empty Midland Grand Hotel would be almost worth moving the whole shebang from Norway for. He wondered if it made any difference, knowing what it was you were walking into. Nervously, tentatively, he walked across and through the space in question. Nothing happened. Oh well. He turned and stood surveying it for a moment or two while he took a couple of slow drags on the cigarette he had got from the tramp. The space didn't look any different. He walked back through it again, this time a little less tentatively, but with slow, positive steps. Once again, nothing happened. But then, just as he was moving out of it at the end, he half-fancied that he half-heard a half-moment of some kind of raucous sound, like a burst of white noise on a twisted radio dial. He turned once more, and headed back into the space, moving his head carefully round, trying to pick up the slightest sound. For a while he didn't catch it. Then suddenly there was a snatch of it that burst around him and was gone. A movement and another snatch. He moved very, very slowly and carefully, with the most slight and gentle movements, trying to catch at the sound. He moved his head round what seemed like a billionth part of a billionth part of a degree, slipped behind a molecule, and was gone.